Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Natasha Heller, one of the hosts of New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. Michelle Wong's new book is Mandalas in the Making, The Visual Culture of Esoteric Buddhism at Dunhuang. This work joins a growing body of scholarship on esoteric Buddhism in China. Wong's research is an important contribution for the way in which she centers murals, portable paintings, ritual manuscripts, and diagrams connected to the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas. She traces how the use of this mandala changed over time and how it was shaped by the distinct cultural and linguistic context at Dunhuang, a key Buddhist site on the Silk Road. This book will reshape scholarly understanding both of mandalas in China, but also of Dunhuang as a Buddhist site. Welcome, Michelle. I'm wondering if we could start by hearing how you ended up in the study of Buddhist art.
Okay. I think that as with many scholars, a lot of that really rested on the strengths of my graduate program, and in particular, what my graduate advisor was working on. And there's a really strong legacy at Harvard, of course, of studies in Buddhist art and also in Dunhuang art. And at that time, I had already had some background in Buddhist art, so that was one direction which I could have gone for PhD studies in my dissertation. Another strong interest of mine was archaeology, but at the time, I think the course offerings and the interests of other graduate students aligned in such a way that there was just a lot of support, I think, and resources for studying Buddhist art in graduate school.
So how did you end up working on this particular research topic?
I discovered this research topic in the Rubel Fine Arts Library at Harvard. So I was fishing for a seminar paper topic. And those of you listeners who are familiar with the resources for Dunhuang will be familiar with a multi-volume series. These are large, oversized folio volumes bound in orange, published in Jiangsu. And each of these volumes focuses on anywhere between one to a few of the case shrines at Dunhuang, and provides really high quality illustrations of the mural paintings. Essentially catalogs. These are essentially illustrated catalogs of the mural paintings. And I was looking for a research paper topic, and I tend to then and still do try to look for topics that appeal to me. That just appealed to me visually, that piqued my curiosity. And so I found myself flipping through each of these orange-bound volumes one by one, and then I came across one, which was for Mokao K14. And, of course, one thing led to another, so I wrote about that for my seminar paper, and I felt that there was still enough left to do on the topic, that the interest was there, that I could work on it for a dissertation topic. And at that time, I felt strongly then, and still do now, that there was still so much to discover that that could also form the basis of a book beyond the dissertation.
It's fascinating. Turning to the book itself, you open in the introduction by talking about how mandalas have been understood by scholars up to this point, and in particular, how Japanese mandalas have influenced the interpretation of Chinese ones. So how would you say your work fits into this existing body of scholarship?
Right. So I think there's probably a really fascinating story to delve into regarding how our knowledge of studies of Japanese Buddhist art, the methodologies that we use for studying Japanese Buddhist art and Japanese Buddhism have affected studies of Chinese Buddhism and Chinese Buddhist art. And what I try to unpack in the introduction to the book is the impact of the Shingon Two Realms Mandala, studies of the Shingon Two Realms Mandala on Buddhist mandalas elsewhere in Asia. And one of the very distinctive characteristics of the Shingon Two Realms Mandala is that we are talking about paired paintings, a pair of portable paintings. So the earliest polychrome set is located in Toji in Kyoto, and very, very large silk paired paintings. And these were hung opposite one another with a small altar for offerings in front of each painting and then with a larger altar in the middle. And the two paintings represent the Garbha Dhatu Mandala and the Vajra Dhatu Mandala, and they're believed to have their own textual bases in the Buddhist canon. And so what I had found when I was doing research for my dissertation and the book was that it was, in fact, not uncommon to describe mandalic phenomena throughout Asia, even outside of Japan, as adhering to the two realm system. So, for example, in the introductory essay to Mokao K14, in the illustrated catalog that I just described earlier, the folio book, the scholar at the Junhua Academy actually tries to interpret the paintings in this cave shrine as adhering to the Japanese Shingon Two Realms Mandala. And we see the effect of this elsewhere as well. So, for example, in the introduction, I talk a little bit about the previous scholarship on the Famen Si reliquaries. So very important Tang Dynasty finds. These have been studied by several scholars. And it's very clear that these nesting reliquaries and then a sculpture of a kneeling bodhisattva that was meant to support the finger bone relic from Famen Si. So these are located in Shanxi province in Central Plains, China. It seems very clear that there is mandalic imagery. And again, scholars initially tried to argue that the iconography adhered to the Two Realms Mandala of Japanese Shingon Buddhism. And more recently, there's been some pushback against that in the more recent scholarship on Famen Si. And this is quite interesting because it really causes us to ask questions about whether esoteric Buddhism in China, whether this was a precursor to esoteric Buddhism in Japan. And of course, there's a long history of the typologies of mixed and pure esotericism, terms that were never used during the Tang or Han periods in pre-modern East Asia, or whether what we see at Dunhuang, which is quite, by the period that I talk about, quite culturally distinct from the central part of China, whether we're talking about a very different set of practices, a very different Buddhist phenomena.
That's fascinating. And I think that your book really shows that it is a different situation. So when you move into when we look at the first chapter, you've titled this From Dharani to Mandala. And I wonder if you might begin by explaining that relationship for us. How do Dharani and Mandala relate?
So, Dharani should be familiar, I think, to many of your listeners. There's been a rich body of recent scholarship on Dharanis, which are Buddhist incantations. And this particular chapter of the book actually draws most closely from the dissertation and the sort of questions that I was asking at that time. And I was particularly interested in one Dharani sutra, pertaining to the Sutra of the Revered and Victorious Dharani of the Buddhist Ushnisha, or the 14th Zunshan Tolani, the Ushnisha Vijaya Dharani. And this circulated widely during the Tang Dynasty in China. So we really see evidence of this in many parts of China, and not only in the Central Plains region, but in Dunhuang as well. And some of the most familiar ways in which this Dharani was, or I guess devotion to the Dharani was carried out, was through the erection of stone pillars. And what I was interested in was the ritual manuals that were based on this Dharani that reimagine it anew in the context of offering rituals. And so what I do in this particular chapter is I look at a series of ritual manuals that are based upon this particular Buddhist incantation. And in particular, two ritual manuals associated with monks who in turn were very strongly associated with the development of esoteric Buddhism with the translation of esoteric Buddhist sutras, namely Shubhakar Simha and Amoghavajra. And in their ritual manuals, what we see is that emphasis on the erection of stone pillars, and these were stone pillars that had the syllables of the Dharani, the characters of the Dharani carved on their surfaces. So what we see is that practice is no longer present in the ritual manuals, but rather what they're describing instead is the production of mandalas, an assembly of deities, and in particular, a configuration in which there are eight attendant deities around a central deity, a central Buddha. And each ritual manual describes a very particular type of image-making process pertaining to this Dharani, pertaining to the ritual offerings based upon the Dharani. So in one ritual manual, one ritual manual, the type of image-making process that is described is an image that is painted directly onto an altar. This was in the manual that was attributed to Amoghavajra. And this in turn, the reason why the deities were painted on the surface of the altar was that these images were meant to serve as a receptacle for the deities of the mandala, and in fact, for the visualization of the deities. So the idea was that during the process of visualizing the deities of the mandala, that in turn, in this practice in turn was tacked onto the Dharani, to the Buddhist incantation, that these images that were painted up to the mandala were receptacle for the visualized deities. So the idea was that this was meant to show the deities to their proper places. And then another type of image that is explained in the ritual manuals is associated with Shubhakar Simha. And this is quite interesting because he describes something a little bit different. So this is meant to be a diagrammatic drawing, and this is made on a portable support, so not on a fixed surface, not on an altar, but rather on a piece of cloth or silk. And what he describes is painting a circle and then dividing that circle further into nine circles, and then each of which in turn serves as the place for one of the deities of the mandala. So I find this quite fascinating. And of course, whenever we look at this type of material, we have to keep in mind that they are prescriptive rather than descriptive. But it is fascinating to me to think about the various material forms in which mandalas may have taken, and particularly in these ritual manuals that are associated with two very important monks of the Tang Dynasty.
Right. So mandalas have this really close relationship with ritual practice.
Yes, absolutely.
So in chapter 2, which is titled The Crowned Buddha and Narratives of Enlightenment, the mandala of the eight great bodhisattvas is central to your discussion. And I'm wondering,
yes,
and I know this is a little hard to do through without images, but could you describe this mandala? It's so central to your work. Could you describe this for us?
Yes. So this is an iconographic configuration that takes a number of material and visual forms. So the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas, described very simply, pertains to a configuration in which there is a central deity, a central Buddha, and this could vary widely throughout Asia. So for example, in the material that I discuss, the central deity is commonly Vairochana or Mahavairochana. So in other parts of Asia, the central deity could, for example, be Amitabha. And some of these variations are inherent in the text pertaining to the Mandalay great bodhisattvas, in which it is not very clear. That is, the identity of the central deity is not very clear to begin with. And so this very likely enabled iconographic variations on this program. And in addition to the central Buddha, there are eight attendant deities, eight bodhisattvas, and these could be arranged around the central Buddha in a variety of spatial forms. So they could be arranged, for example, in two vertical rows. And this is a spatial configuration that we see in some of the examples of the Mandala of Eight Great Bodhisattvas, especially rock carvings that are seen in early Tibet. This is also a configuration that we see at Dunhuang as well, for example, in Yilin Caves 20 and 38. And then another spatial configuration is that we might see the eight bodhisattvas arranged instead in two rows on either side of the Buddha. So rather than being arranged in two rows, they would be arranged, in four rows total. So two rows on the left side of the Buddha and two rows on the right side of the Buddha. And this is something that we see as well at Dunhuang and also in early Tibet. And then finally, another configuration is one in which the eight bodhisattvas are arranged in a circular form around the central Buddha. And this is something that we see at Dunhuang as well. And so in addition to these different spatial configurations, the mandala also appears in a variety of material forms. So in some cases, this was a fixed image. So there are some well-known examples of this particular mandala in Western India. There are also examples that are painted on silk. So there's one important example that's housed in the British Museum. And then, of course, this was also conveyed in mural paintings as well. So there are a lot of variations, both in the spatial arrangement of the deities and also material format throughout Asia.
So in this chapter, which I mentioned the title, you talk about a crowned Buddha. And how the image of this crowned Buddha points to another understanding of enlightenment. So what does this crowned Buddha represent?
So you mentioned the crowned Buddha, and this is actually one intriguing, consistent aspect of the iconography of the Mandala of Eight Great Bodhisattvas, as we see it in early Tibet and also at Dunhuang. So I'm looking at the period between the 8th to 10th centuries, and this appellation crown Buddha, we are referring simply to a central Buddha who wears a tall crown. And then the Buddha is typically shown seated on a lotus pedestal. There are two lions below the lotus pedestal. And then the Buddha typically holds his hands in the mudra meditation or the dhyana mudra, with one hand held above the palm of the other hand. And I think the consistency in the lion throne and in the mudra of meditation, the dhyana mudra, and also the crown is very important to point out because, as I mentioned earlier, there are many variations on the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas, not only in the spatial layout of the attendant deities, but also in the central Buddha itself. And so this is something that we see in early Tibet and also at Dunhuang. And what drew my attention in looking at the scholarship on the Mandala of Eight Great Bodhisattvas, especially in the context of early Tibet, was that they frequently evoked Akanishta heaven. And I started to look into this a little bit more, especially into the textual sources pertaining to Akanishta heaven. And as it turns out, this is a realm that is referred to in a number of Buddhist texts, both pertaining to, exoteric as well as esoteric Buddhism. And this relates to the heaven of the final limit of form. And more simply put, this was where Shakyamuni is described in a variety of texts as having been crowned by the Buddhas of the Ten Directions. So this would account for the crown worn on the head, and then is recognized as Mahavairochana. And so I interpret the iconography of the crown Buddha then in light of these consistent iconographic characteristics. We see it on the lion throne, the Dhyana Mudra, and also the crown. And also in light of two narratives pertaining to the Buddha's enlightenment. So I have just described one that is what I would characterize as the alternative understanding of the Buddha's enlightenment, that is his coronation in Akanishita heaven. And then the narrative of the Buddha's enlightenment that many of us are more familiar with is the story of Siddhartha Gautama meditating under the Bodhi tree. And then, of course, withstanding the assault of Mara and then attaining awakening by daybreak. So because of the conjunction of the mood of meditation and also the crown worn on the Buddha's head, I conclude that these collectively pertain to the Buddha's meditation, or I should say Siddhartha's meditation or the Bodhi tree, as well as the coronation in Akanishita heaven. So I believe that in this particular context, that is in the context of early Tibet and then the Tibetan period at Junhuang and also the post-Tibetan period, so this spans the 8th to 10th centuries, that this particular iconographic form, the crown Buddha in the context of the eight bodhisattvas mandala, might have been drawn from a conflation of these two narratives of enlightenment, that is both the meditation under the Bodhi tree as well as the coronation of the Buddha's Mahavarosha in Akanishita heaven. And another fascinating thing is that when I took a look at textual sources relating to Akanishita heaven, they frequently describe the Buddha as seated on a lion throne. And so this, I think, accounts for the third aspect of this iconography.
So in this chapter, you use a phrase that I thought was really interesting, and that is visual and linguistic bilingualism. So what does this mean in the case of Dunhuang?
So my thoughts about this emerged from reading the scholarship, this really rich body of scholarship that's been produced in the past few decades on bilingual manuscripts at Dunhuang. And so these are manuscripts that were brushed in more than one language. In some cases, another language was brushed as an interior source. There's also a rich body of dictionaries for translation and that sort of thing. And alongside this body of scholarship is also a body of scholarship that demonstrates that even after the period of the Tibetan presence in Dunhuang, so Dunhuang was ruled by the Tibetan Empire between 786, roughly 786 to 848. So there's some discussion about those dates, but basically from the late or the third quarter of the 8th century to the middle of the 9th century. And what is so fascinating is that this body of scholarship demonstrates that, first of all, not only did Tibetan continue to be used as a writing system in Dunhuang and in Central Asia, and very likely because this is a phonetic writing system, unlike Chinese, and therefore could be adapted to the writing not only of Tibetan, but other languages as well. And the evidence from the manuscripts demonstrates that the post-Tibetan rulers of Dunhuang also used Tibetan to communicate with other with Central Asians during the post-Tibetan period. But based upon the research, especially by scholars who worked on Tibetan manuscripts, we now also know that many of the ritual manuscripts, especially those pertaining to esoteric Buddhist rituals, very likely date not only to the post-Tibetan period, but maybe as late as the 10th century. And so I sort of thought about the visual impact of seeing different writing systems side by side, and that gave me maybe sort of a methodological conceptual apparatus for thinking through the conjunction of different painting styles that we see at Dunhuang in the Mokau and also in the Yilin cave shrines. And one thing that I found particularly fascinating about the mural paintings is that, and I should say that there are four examples of mural paintings of the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas, or I should say they are in four caves at Dunhuang. So these are Yilin cave 25, Mokau Cave 14, and then Yilin Caves 20 and 38. I think Yilin Cave 25 is probably the most well-known because the amount of scholarship that has already been carried out on that particular painting. But going back to what I was saying then about the different painting styles is that I had noticed for some time that it seemed very obvious to me that the Mandalay Grey Basad was painted in such a way that it looked very Tibetan in style. And what I mean by this is an elongation and robustness in the body. And this is very different from what I characterize as the Tang style, in which the face and the body are very, very round, without the kind of elongated, sensual quality of the Tibetan style. And there are, of course, issues associated with terming one style Tibetan and one style Tang. But the reason why I use these terms is because I believe that the painting styles were employed simultaneously in order to suggest perhaps the coexistence of Tang and Tibetan cultures at Junhuang. And so we not only see the conjunction of the Tang Tibetan painting styles, but in some cases, what's really fascinating is that at Yilin Caves 20 and 38, there are paintings, two paintings in both caves of the Mandala of Eight Great Bodhisattvas that seem to be paired with one another. And what we see is that in one of those paintings, the Buddha is painted in a distinctively Tibetan Himalayan style. And then in the other painting, the Buddha will have been painted in a Tang style. So we actually see those two painting styles literally face to face with one another. And some scholars have argued that the reason why we see the conjunction of different painting styles in the cave shrines might have to do with their having been painted at different times. And I actually tend to disagree with that because I have visited the cave shrines and I don't see the markers, the obvious markers of overpainting that one sees in other cave shrines. And I try to think of the conjunction of painting styles in a way that might bring us back to the bilingualism that we see in the Junhuang manuscripts. And so I try to think of this as a purposeful mingling of painting styles rather than painting styles that were attributed to different historical periods. So in essence, what I was trying to do was to look at the Junhuang manuscripts not only as a basis for the iconographic programs of cave shrines, but to sort of dig a little bit deeper and see whether there's anything else going on in the manuscripts, that is, putting the two languages, Chinese and Tibetan, side by side, and whether that was reflected in other ways in the cave shrines as well. And I think that that is reflected in the conjunction of the Tang and Tibetan painting styles.
So you've just used the phrase purposeful mingling, and that has a lot to do with the history of Junhuang. And so thinking about turning to chapter 3, which is titled Mandalas and Historical Memory, in that chapter you begin with Zhang Yichao ousting the Tibetans in the mid-9th century. Why was this particular event significant in tracing the use of mandalas at Junhuang?
Well, we know that the Mandala of Eight Great Bodhisattvas was very important under the Tibetan Empire, even prior to the historical event that you just alluded to, that is Zhang Yichao's ouster of the Tibetans from Junhuang. There are, of course, also still some questions remaining about how large that Tibetan presence actually was and how large the population was even after this particular event. And the Mandala of Eight Great Bodhisattvas was important because there are a few examples in which the dedicatory inscriptions state that the mandala was painted in order to commemorate a peace treaty, a very important peace treaty of the 820s between the Tang and Tibetan armies. And when we think about the rulers of the Return to Allegiance Army, that is the Chinese rulers of Junhuang after the mid-9th century, after the ouster of Tibetans, I think it's important to keep in mind that because of the long period of Tibetan rule in Junhuang, over 60 years or so, that people like Zhang Yichao grew up in what was very much a culturally Tibetan environment. So we do know, for example, that, and this was not uncommon, this was probably not uncommon for the time, that he had a Tibetan name. He himself brushed Buddhist manuscripts in Tibetan. And so this was simply the sort of environment that they grew up in. And so I hypothesize that for these reasons, that the rulers of the Return to Allegiance Army, which ruled Junhuang after the ouster of the Tibetans in roughly 848, that they continued to employ the Mandala of Eight Great Bodhisattvas purposely in their cave shrines. So not only the Zhang clan, but also the Cao clan, which ruled Junhuang, after the Zhang clan lost power. And so I think that this could explain, for example, the continuation of the Manlave Great Bodhisattvas at Dunhuang really well into the Return to Allegiance Army period. And secondly, and this goes back to the purposeful mingling of these painting styles, I look at Cave 156, and this is a cave that is very well known for an iconographic program in which the victory of Zhang Yichao is memorialized in a the mural paintings that are show the procession of Zhang Yichao, his victorious procession and victory over the Tibetans. And what's really fascinating about this cave is that there is a niche in the west wall which houses the Buddha icon. And the west wall niche has a truncated pyramid ceiling, and this is a very common ceiling type that we see in Dunhuang, not only in the main ceiling of the king shrine, that is in the main chamber of the cave shrine, but also in some of the niches inside of which clay sculptures, clay icons were installed. And what I mean by truncated pyramid ceiling is basically a ceiling type that has four ceiling slopes, and then the pinnacle of the ceiling is flat. And what's very interesting about this is that there are two deities painted on the eastern ceiling slope of the west wall niche. So they're very hard to see. If you are standing right in front of the niche and looking at the icon, you would actually have to kind of lean into the niche and then twist your body around and then turn your face upward in order to get a view of the paintings on the east wall. And I should backtrack for a moment and say that the paintings on the other ceiling slopes, the ones that are easy to see from the perspective of the viewer who's standing right in front of the clay icon, that those are all painted in the standard Tang style, the quote-unquote Tang style. But the paintings that are located on the east ceiling slope are painted in what I describe as the Tibetan style, and they're very much hidden from the viewer. And so I hypothesized that this might be due to, first of all, the continuation of maybe an interest in Tibetan culture, Tibetan language in Dunhuang, even after the end of the Tibetan period. And secondly, that it might have been hidden from view because from historical chronicles, it seems very likely that even though the Zhang clan pledged allegiance to the central Tang court in Chang'an, that there was still some suspicion about where their loyalties actually lay. So we know, for example, that Zhang Yichao sent envoys multiple times to Chang'an before receiving official recognition from the court, and then also his older brother had to stay in Chang'an as a hostage in order to demonstrate the loyalty of the clan. And so for me, this is particularly interesting because this painting, this that is almost hidden from view, really seems to complicate or contradict the straightforward message of Zhang Yichao's victorious procession into Dunhuang. And so going back to the Tibetan cultural environment in which Zhang Yichao was reared and how that relates to the Manlave of a Great Bodhisattva, so I believe that there are cave shrines at Dunhuang and also at the Mokau Caves and also at the Yilin Caves, in which we see the Manlave Eight Great Bodhisattvas. And I argue that those were produced under the patronage of the Return to Allegiance Army. So members of the Zhang clan as well as members of the Cao clan.
So also in Chapter 3, you have, I think, what may be my most favorite image in this book. And that is this image from the Musée Guimet that shows the mandala of the five Buddhas with donor figures. I'm wondering if you could walk us through this image and what it shows.
Mm-hmm. This is a very complex image, and I'm not surprised that it appeals to you so much because it's very brightly colored and it's unusual for a number of reasons that also contributes to our knowledge of mandalas at Dunhuang. So to begin with, as the title suggests, this is mandala of five bodhisattvas. Five Buddhas, actually. And these are the five Buddhas of the Vajradhatu mandala. And this goes back to something that we were discussing earlier in our conversation, which is how this work, this book, fits into the scholarly discourse, or maybe responding to the emphasis, the position that studies of Japanese mandalas have had in the interpretation of mandalas elsewhere in Asia. And one of the arguments that I make is that the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas had a long history of, precisely because of its eightfold structure, that it was argued by many scholars as having been an early prototype of the Garbhadhatu mandala. And the reason for that is that at the very center of the Garbhadhatu mandala, we actually see Mahavrakshana in the center of an eight-petaled lotus. The difference, of course, is that in the Garbhadhatu mandala, the central Buddha, Mahavrakshana, is surrounded not by eight bodhisattvas, but rather by four Buddhas and four bodhisattvas. So even though the imagery of the central Buddha seated at the center of an open lotus blossom seems to evoke the appearance of the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas, the spatial configuration of eight attendant deities around the central Buddha, I think that they actually stem from very different iconographic lineages. And so one of the arguments I make is that I think the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas is actually much more closely aligned with the Vajradhatu mandala for a number of reasons, and also I guess, ritual practice associated with the Vajradhatu mandala, especially as it was interpreted at Dunhuang. So going back to this particular mandala, there are five Buddhas. And one of the fascinating things is that the Buddhas are actually painted in the, that is, their bodies are actually painted in the color that is appropriate to their, the direction, the cardinal direction that they represent. And this is highly unusual. So we know that such color systems were in place. So for example, we have Mahavrakshana in the center, again, crowned and seated upon a lion throne and with his hands held in the Dhyana Mudra, the Mudra of Meditation, and his body is painted gold. And then we see Ratnasambhava, the Buddha of the South, with blue skin corresponding to that cardinal direction. Amitabha, representing the Western cardinal, with red skin. And we really don't see these color designations in other images at Dunhuang. So this is highly unusual. And so the central Buddha, my version, is in the center. And then four corners opposite him are the four Buddhas representing the four cardinal directions, the four Buddhas from so these represent collectively the five Buddhas of the Vajradhatu mandala. And these take up roughly two-thirds of the upper part of the painting. And I should also mention this is a very small painting, and this might suggest the circumstances of the patronage. So the total height of the painting is just a little over 100 centimeters. So this would actually be around 40 inches or so, so definitely under 4 feet. So this is not a spectacularly huge painting. So when we think of mandalas, again, I think a lot of us tend to think of the Two Realms mandala, and which are very, very large. You know, we've all seen them reproduced in textbooks. This is actually rather a small, intimate image. And that might pertain to the fact that this was actually, that the donors actually came from a family, and that this particular mandala painting was, from the Dedicatory inscriptions, seemed to have been that the occasion for the production of painting must have been the occasion of a mortuary ritual for one of the family members. So going back to the painting then, the upper two-thirds are taken up by the five Buddhas, and not only are they painted, their bodies painted different colors, but they're also seated on pedestals, and each of the pedestals is the animal that is the animal mount, that is supposed to be the animal mount of that particular Buddha representing a particular quadrant. And then we also see other deities attending the Buddhas, and in particular, we see the offering goddesses, the eight inner and outer offering goddesses of the Vajradhatu mandala. So as I mentioned earlier, in the images from early Tibetan Dinhuang, the central Buddha of the eight bodhisattvas mandala could be Vairokshana or Mahavairokshana. And one of the clearest distinctions between the two is that in images of Mahavairokshana, both in the context of the five Buddhas of the Vajradhatu mandala, and also in the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas, is that we see the Buddhas, in this case, or bodhisattvas, accompanied by the inner and outer offering goddesses. And these are some of the minor deities that we see in the Vajradhatu mandala, both in the more abbreviated form, in which you see only the five Buddhas, in the more complex form of the Vajradhatu Mandala in the Shingon tradition, and also in the context of the eight Bodhisattva Mandala, in which the central deity is Mahavairochana, that is the esoteric Mahavairochana rather than Vairochana. So we see the offering goddesses as well. And then if we move further down the painting, we see an offering altar. So previously I discussed the altars as support for the visualization of deities of a mandala. And this is quite interesting because we can actually see there are perceptible shifts throughout the painting. And so we can see this mandala altar. And we know it's an altar because there are lamps on either side and ritual implements, such as water bottles and offerings and so forth. And we can see it as if we're looking at it face down. And at the very center of this mandala offer is an eight-petaled lotus blossom. So interestingly, this seems to maybe suggest precisely the sort of altar on which the places of the deities were painted. And then at the bottommost part of the painting, we see the donut images. And here there's yet again another perspectival shift in which these figures are foreshortened and they occupy a clearly defined ground plane. So we can see a number of female donor figures to the left side of yet another offering altar, again with offerings and then with lamps. And then on the right hand side, we can see a monk donor and then other male donor figures. And the donor figures on both sides of the altar are kneeling on mats and they're facing the center. And going back to a point that I made earlier, that this small-scale intimate image seemed to have been sponsored on the occasion of a mortuary ritual. Based on the donor inscriptions, we can tell that the male donor figure on the right-hand side, to the right-hand side of the monk, or behind the monk, was actually the deceased father of the donor. And the female donor figures also represent deceased family members. So the deceased mother of the donor and the deceased daughter of the donor. So it seems very likely that a living donor commissioned this painting in order to sponsor a mortuary ritual for the deceased family members. And so this seems to bring together the family members in the performance of a ritual. So we see them kneeling and facing altar, kind of suggesting the continuation of such rituals in death, even as in life. And what's particularly fascinating about this image is that not only is it highly complex and very colorful with the color designations for the bodies, but we see mandalas referenced a number of times. So we see the five Buddhas of the Vajradhatu Mandala at the very top of the painting, as I mentioned, occupying really almost two-thirds of the painting. And then we also see the altar, which has an eight-petal lotus. And that also suggests, because of its structure, this eightfold structure that's very closely associated with mandalas, it also suggests perhaps another mandala, perhaps something maybe generated through a process of visualization, meditative visualization.
So this image really shows how mandalas were connected to rituals. And that's an issue you also take up in chapter 4, which is titled Mandalas, Repentance, and Vision. And in particular here, you're concerned with repentance rituals and taking the Bodhisattva precepts. So what role do mandalas play in this particular context?
Okay. So in this particular context, and I also want to backtrack for a moment to say that not only were mandalas, do they play a prominent role in the ritual life of local population, but also for lay people as well. So the donors that we see in the painting, with the exception of one donor, are obviously lay people. And I think that's really important to keep in mind as well, because if we go back to sort of our knowledge, the deep knowledge that we have of the Shingon Two Realms mandala, I think we're generally thinking of mandalas in the context of monastic initiation rituals. And here we can see very clearly that the painting of mandalas was actually sponsored, could be sponsored and was sponsored by lay people, both in portable paintings, like the small painting I just described, and also in mural paintings. And then to answer your question more directly, so you asked about mandalas and what role they played in repentance rituals. And I was looking in particular at one Dunhuang manuscript in the Paleo Collection, number 3920. And there are two ritual manuals in this particular manuscript that describe repentance rituals. And these rituals are quite fascinating because they the spatial template that is described in the rituals seems to evoke the Vajradhatu mandala. So, for example, there are references that are made to the 37 deities, so the 37 core deities of the Vajradhatu mandala. And there's also a sequence of the five Buddhas, so the five Buddhas of the Vajradhatu mandala, such as the ones pictured in the painting that we just discussed. And these are mentioned in the ritual sequences as well. And then some of the ritual implements include the wielding of vajras and the wearing of a five Buddhist crown. This would also draw upon the Vajradhatu mandala. And then in addition to the main text of the manuscripts, there are also interlinear notations that are made. And these are quite interesting because, of course, these could have been made at a later point in time, but these make references to a five Buddhas, eight Bodhisattvas altar. And so there are, these are small notations that are made in small script, small characters, interlinear notations. And so there are references made in a number of points. So, for example, in one of the manuals that describes an altar, circumambulating altar, there's a small notation that's made to the five Buddhas and eight Bodhisattvas. And I conclude that this might suggest that the altar that is being circumambulated is a five Buddhas, eight Bodhisattvas altar. And in addition, there is also another such notation that is made in the context of a reference to one of the stages of the repentance ritual. And then also notation that's made to and a Bodhisattva's Abhisheka. There are also other interlinear notations that are made in reference to an altar of Mahavrakshana and these 37 deities. Again, references to the Vajradhatu mandala, and both in the context of the 37 core deities of the Vajradhatu mandala, and also to the five Buddhas, the five main Buddhas of the Vajradhatu mandala, in conjunction with the eight Bodhisattvas. And so I find these notations quite interesting, and the references to the five Buddhas' altars, five Buddhas, eight Bodhisattvas' altars, are also echoed in other sources, other manuscript sources at Dunhuang. And so another thing that I was trying to do in this chapter, in addition to trying to think a little bit about the ritual context for mandalas at Dunhuang and also how this might have informed or might have pertained to the iconographic program of cave shrines, is also the type of information that that we get from different types of manuscripts. So the manuscript that I just referred to, the one in the Paleo Collection 3920, gives very detailed textual instructions to how the ritual should be carried out. There are the small interlinear notations that I mentioned. There are also other markings. So other scholars are currently working on these manuscript markings. But there are no diagrams. There are no illustrations. And so they seem to describe these rather complicated altars, but there are no visuals to accompany the text. And then in this emphasis on conveying information textually rather than visually is carried out in another manuscript, which also describes altars. Again, some pertain to the five Buddhas and also to the eight Bodhisattvas. And then we have yet another manuscript, also from the Pali Collection 2012, in which we have diagrams of altars and no text accompanying them. So it's fascinating to think through how practitioners at Dunhuang might have made use of these different types of materials and how they might have relied on a set of materials rather than one manuscript alone in order to learn the sort of practices that were carried out that in conjunction with the mandalas.
So Chapter 5 takes you, as you title it, beyond the mandala, and here you focus on the sutra on the names of the Buddha, and also on different representations of bodhisattvas. And especially important in this chapter is the influence of the Gandavyuha chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. Could you explain how this all connects for us?
Yes, yes. So I was actually really fascinated by something I read in literature that pointed out that in the Gandabuha chapter, and the Gandabuha chapter relates the pilgrimage of Sudana, the boy pilgrim Sudana, who visits 53 spiritual mentors or Kalyana Mitra in order to learn the way of the Bodhisattva. And there's a sequence of eight goddesses among these 53 Kalyana Mitra in which they are arranged in a circular fashion at Bodhgaya, which of course was the site of the enlightenment of Shakyamuni under the Bodhi tree. And this seems to suggest a circular arrangement that is very mandala-like, similar in fact to the circular configuration of eight bodhisattvas that we do see in some of the imagery, in for example, in the mural painting in Mogalke 14. And so that was quite interesting to me. And also going back to the 53 Kalyana Mitra, these 53 spiritual mentors with whom Sudana meets, my attention was drawn to a series of paintings of bodhisattvas in Mogalke 14. So this is a cave that belongs to the post-Tibetan period at Dunhuang. And I believe that may have been sponsored under the patronage of the Zhang clan of the Return to Allegiance Army, the rulers of Dunhuang after the Tibetan period. And there is a sequence of bodhisattvas, and these spread across all four walls of the cave shrine. And there are 51 of them altogether. And they're actually quite tall. They're not quite life-size, but they're actually rather tall, strikingly tall. And in addition to the 51 bodhisattvas, there are also large paintings flanking the entrance, which is on the east wall, of Manjushri and Samantabhadra. And what I found particularly compelling is that if we add together the two paintings of Samantabhadra and Manjushri, the core bodhisattvas associated with the Avatamsaka Sutra and also with the Gandabuha chapter, so the first and last spiritual mentors with whom Sudana meets, that if we add those to the 51 bodhisattvas, that this actually forms a cycle of 53. And I found the number to be highly suggestive, and I want to look into this a little bit further. And these bodhisattvas, these are standing bodhisattvas, each of them enclosed within its own frame. And these tend to become more common around this period, that is the post-Tibetan period at Dunhuang. And they do not appear in other caves in such great numbers, and they do not appear spread across all four walls. Also, what's particularly compelling, in addition to the relatively tall size, is the fact that there is a painting on the north wall of the cave of Mogalke 14. So this would be on your right as you enter, all the way toward the rear wall, so the conjunction of the two walls in the corner, in which there seems to be a prompt towards circumambulation, because the deity painted on that wall, Vajrasattvas, his head points toward the right, and this almost seems to prompt the viewer to move in that direction. That would be actually clockwise, maybe suggest a clockwise circumambulation. So that's something that I discussed in this chapter as well. So there seems to be kind of a spatiality in a sequence, in a sense of movement that's prompted by these bodhisattva paintings in conjunction with other paintings in the cave. So going back to the Sutra on the Names of the Buddha, so in each, for the 51 bodhisattvas that are located closest to the floor, and as I mentioned, each of them in their own frame, there's a cartouche. And for most of the cartouches, the inscriptions have faded due to sun exposure. And I was able to retrieve information from some of the cartouches that are located on the rear wall, on the west wall. And this is because they were shielded from sun exposure by the pillar in the middle of the main chamber of the cave shrine. So these shielded the inscriptions on the rear wall from sun exposure. And when I punched these into C-beta, I was very surprised to find that What I pulled up was actually some hits in the Sutra on the Names of the Buddha, which of course is not an esoteric sutra, and it has nothing to do with, really on the face of it, with the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas or with the Vajradhatu mandala or with any of the sutras that pertain to mandalas. But what the Sutra on the Names of the Buddha does have to, what that does relate to is repentance. And so I think that repentance is a unifying feature in this particular cave shrine. And for those in your audience who are familiar with Junhuang art, there are some members of your audience who might be familiar, for example, with the very popular Thousand Buddhas motif at Junhuang. This is a repetitive motif of small seated Buddhas. And this is a motif that scholars have demonstrated draws upon the Sutra on the Names of the Buddha. So what is particularly interesting then about these relatively large bodhisattvas in Mogal Cave 14 in their names? So these are actually bodhisattva names that were brushed inside the cartouches located next to each of the bodhisattvas, is that the Sutra on the Names of the Buddha not only conveys the names of the Buddhas, but it also conveys the names of bodhisattvas as well, and sutras names also. So this seems to be maybe a form of repentance that emphasizes bodhisattvas rather than the Buddhas that we commonly associate with the Thousand Buddhas motif at Junhuang. And the emphasis on bodhisattvas, also brings me back to the eight bodhisattvas. And my attention was drawn to the Bhadrachari, and this is also important in the context of the Gandavyuha and the Avatamsaka Sutra. And this is a text that was appended to the Gandavyuha chapter, and this exists in several forms from Junhuang. So we see this represented in the Junhuang manuscripts. And this is important, I think, for two reasons. First of all, this also formed the basis of repentance rituals. And secondly, there is one particular translation of the Bhadrachari, attributed to Mogavajra, in which, and this is distinct from the other translations of the Bhadrachari, because there is a eulogy of the eight bodhisattvas on the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas inserted into this particular translation into the Bhadrachari. And so I speculate that since it has already been demonstrated that mandalas play a role in repentance rituals, that the bodhisattvas painted in Mogal Cave 14 also likely pertain to repentance rituals, that perhaps the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas may have had yet even greater resonance in the context of repentance rituals, in that they are referenced in the Bhadrachari. And that in turn might serve as a link between the sequence of bodhisattvas, the 53 bodhisattvas, and the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas. That is, the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas may have made sense equally in esoteric contexts. And it's also a motif that appears in other contexts as well that are not necessarily esoteric. So in the context of the Bhadrachari, which in turn was associated with the Gandavyuha chapter, so a source which is decidedly non-esoteric. So this is sort of a long-winded way of saying that the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas played an important role in repentance rituals, and that the repentance rituals very likely drew on a number of sources. I think that this helps us understand the iconographic program of one of the cave shrines at Junhuang Mogal Cave 14, which contains an important example of the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas. And at the same time that the repentance rituals and the resonance of the mandala of eight great bodhisattvas may have spanned not only the esoteric traditions, but possibly also the Huayan traditions or Mahayana exoteric traditions as well.
So you've made a really compelling case for the complexity of influences and practices at Dunhuang. And in the epilogue to your work, you refer to Dunhuang as a third space. I'm wondering if, to kind of sum up, you could tell us what you mean by this and tell us why you think this site is so important for understanding esoteric Buddhism in China.
Okay, so by describing Jinhong as a third space, and this is a term that comes from post-colonial theory, this takes us back to a point that you raised earlier in our conversation, that is trying to use this material to address the influence in studies of Chinese and other mandalas, that is Buddhist mandalas elsewhere in Asia, the influence that has been exerted upon this material by studies on Japanese mandalas. And what is particularly striking about Jinhong and the Jinhong mandalas is precisely the way in which they really speak to the meeting of different cultures, in particular the meeting of the Chinese and Tibetan cultures. And in some cases, that correspondence, that dialogue, is expressed really nice in a spatial way. So, for example, the pairing of mandalas that alternate between the Tang and Tibetan styles. There are also, of course, I mentioned earlier the bilingual manuscripts. There are also cartouches associated with the mandala by great bodhisattvas that were oriented vertically as well as horizontally in order to accommodate Chinese as well as Tibetan scripts. In other cases, there are diagrams. So there are also diagrams, ink monochrome diagrams of mandalas, which have no inscriptions. And this really speaks to the difficulty then of kind of teasing out clear-cut distinctions between Chinese and Tibetan. So I see this material, this body of material, is really speaking to an in-between quality, the in-between quality of Jinhong, particularly during the Tibetan and post-Tibetan periods, in which you have the period of Tibetan rule, and then even after the period of Tibetan rule, that is during the Guizhun, or return to allegiance army period, that rules up until the early 11th century, that you continue to have the Tibetan presence that exists in the form of the use of the Tibetan writing system that we see also in painting styles. And so there's a very interesting dialogue between the two cultures, between two writing systems, between two artistic styles. And I think there are other ways as well in which the sort of Buddhism that was practiced at Jinhong at this time also suggests dialogue between Chinese and Tibetan cultures. So another issue that I raise is kind of the parallel quality of the ritual practices that we see evidenced by the manuscript evidence at Jinhong. So for example, not only based upon the Vajradhatu mandala, but also I talk very briefly about the yet another tantra, the Sarva Durgati Parshadana Tantra, which is strongly associated with Tibetan Buddhism. And there are certainly elements of that tantra, that cycle, that strongly echo the Ushnisha Vijaya that we talked about very early on in our conversation. So there's very interesting dialogue, I think, that takes place at various levels. In religious praxis, in artistic practice, in manuscript culture. And I think it really speaks to the hybrid quality, the multicultural nature of Jinhong. And so this, I think, is really important to keep in mind when we're thinking about a very specific context in which Buddhist mandalas developed, a very specific spatial, geographic, cultural context that might have been very distinct from what was happening in Central Plains China.
Michelle, we've taken up quite a bit of your time, but before we go, I want to ask, what's next for you? Are you working on a new research project, or do you have plans for one?
Well, I'm currently working on an article-length project, and this extends my interest in the post-Tibetan period at Jinhong, and it's on paintings of Mahamayuri, an esoteric Buddhist deity, commonly shown seated on a peacock mount. And so I'm interested both in mural paintings and also in one example of this particular deity, the Peacock Wisdom King, that was painted as a portable painting. So I'm interested in, for example, why these images appear at Jinhong only during the 10th century, and whether there may have been some connection between the circulation of these images to Jinhong and the intermarriage between the Cao clan that ruled Dunhuang in the post-Tibetan period and the Kingdom of Khotan. And then the long term, I'm pursuing a project on Buddhist sculpture. And here I'm particularly interested in materiality and in sort of ways of thinking about how materiality might have informed the sacrality of Buddhist sculpture. So right now the plan is to explore Buddhist statues that were made in different materials. So one of which is sandalwood, and the resonance of sandalwood in Buddhism, you know, I think is very obvious. And other materials would be stone, maybe bronze, and so forth. And this was really sparked by an article that I did earlier on miracle tales concerning statues that came to life. And their descriptions, kind of very precise descriptions of statues that were discovered under rather fantastical, even miraculous circumstances, and with a lot of attention being paid to their material properties. And some of the miraculous qualities of those statues in turn really came to rest on how the way in which these animated statues behaved, the way in which they moved and interacted with devotees actually defied the limitations of their materiality. So for example, stone statues that suddenly became very light, things of that nature. So that's, I'm kind of at the beginning of stages of that right now. So we'll see how that goes.
That sounds amazing. I will really look forward to your work on statues. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us this afternoon and for chatting with us about your book.
Okay. Thank you, Natasha. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network.